Okay. Well, the first thing I want you to do is to set H-bar to zero. I'm going to be talking about the black holes that we actually think exist and some of their theoretical ramifications, and they are not really dominated by quantum effects. They are very large black holes. Now, if black holes in classical general relativity have no hair, then these black holes are more balding than average. They certainly have mass, and as I will argue later, the spin of these holes is very important from an astrophysical point of view, but electric charge is completely negligible. If it were important, these black holes sit in the real universe, not the rarefied intellectual universe, and they would quickly find a way to neutralize themselves. Now, as Andy Fabian discussed before in the last talk, we do know quite a bit now about the likely populations of black holes in the universe. There are two observed populations. One of these populations is comes from the collapse of massive stars. They're stellar remnant black holes, and they probably have masses in the range of about 3 to 30 times the mass of the Sun. The lower and upper limits might be off by as much as a factor of 1.5 to 2, but they're not likely to be seriously different from that. I'm sorry about the hard-to-read typeface here. When I showed up yesterday with my PC, it refused to talk to this projector, and so we quickly ported this to a Mac, and it did some strange things like change the colors of the equations and scramble some of the later ones, as you will see. But, you know, nobody reads the equations anyway. They're just there to impress you, so they'll look even more impressive now. There are probably in the range of millions to even tens or hundreds of millions of these stellar remnant black holes per galaxy. These numbers are quite uncertain because we don't know exactly what the distribution of stellar masses are as they're formed in different galactic environments. And we also know that massive stars lose a lot of mass before their centers collapse, and we don't really know very well how much mass they lose. The second population consists of the supermassive black holes, which are located at the centers of galaxies. The masses we know about range from less than a million solar masses to more than a billion solar masses. Again, these limits are uncertain, particularly at the low end. There could be populations of lower mass holes, and in fact, our knowledge of what I call medium mass holes of 100 to a million solar masses, we know very little about their abundance and whether they're very important. Of the supermassive black holes, there's probably one at the center of most galaxies, or at least a large fraction of galaxies. There may be more than one. And in particular, we believe that there must be, from time to time, mergers of black holes because there are mergers of galaxies. And if two galaxies merged, then gravitational relaxation effects would tend to make both holes sink toward the center and form a binary and eventually possibly coalesce. Getting back to the quantum, of course, there is one might imagine that there could be evaporating black holes evaporating through the Hawking process. If these were to be evaporating in the current universe, they would have to have a mass comparable to the mass of a typical mountain on Earth, about 10 to the 15 or 16 grams, I think. People have actually looked for flashes from these holes, and at the moment there is no evidence that they exist in any abundance. Okay, the key questions that we ask about black holes are things like how did they form? We believe that the stellar remnant black holes formed through the collapse of stars, in fact we don't know that much about exactly which stars give rise to black holes and which stars would give rise to neutron stars. We have extremely compelling evidence, as Andy discussed, that there are compact dark masses in the centers of galaxies and in some of these X-ray binaries, but we have very limited information, really little information about whether these are the black holes predicted by classical general relativity, and so we would like to answer that fundamental question. And in our role as astrophysicists, aha, yes, I knew this would happen. Back. No. Good. What role do these play? I have to remember only to click when I see a red thing. What role do these black holes play in astrophysical phenomena? Not only their production of energy in the centers of quasars and very dramatic energy-producing objects, but also do they have a larger role as participants in the formation and evolution of galaxies, in stellar evolution, and even in the development of the large-scale structure of the universe and galaxy clusters? Okay. Well, there are really only three astrophysically interesting features of black holes, and only two of these are fundamentally general relativistic features. The first characteristic of a black hole is they have a very deep gravitational potential, and the idea there is that if you drop material into the black hole, it goes deep into the gravitational potential well and acquires a tremendous amount of energy, and if you can figure out a way of extracting that energy and allowing it to radiate out into space, either in the form of photons or perhaps even kinetic energy, as I'll show later, you can get an output that ranges from 6% to perhaps 42% of the mc squared of the mass you drop into the hole's potential. And even at the low end, which corresponds to a Schwarzschild metric, the high end is for extreme Kerr, this is about a factor of 10 larger than the maximum energy you can extract from nuclear reactions. The second property is the existence of an event horizon. And the interesting point there, of course, is that if black holes do not have a hard surface, that they you can if something does get below the horizon and carries energy with it and doesn't manage to give up most of that energy before it drops below the horizon, that energy goes into the black hole and goes into increasing the mass of the hole as well. And that means that, in fact, you can build, in principle, you might also be able to build up very large masses in the universe without an observable signature. So, in fact, it may be that you have these very important dynamical features, and one possibility, of course, is that you have a tremendous source of energy coming out in association with the growth of these features, but an alternative possibility is, in fact, they can be built up with very little signature, and in fact, there is some observational evidence for black holes which are absorbing or accreting matter, but radiating a very little fraction of the rest mass energy in the process. And examples are the galactic center black hole, which is actually a very faint astrophysical source, the radio galaxy that Andy discussed, M87, which had the 3 billion solar mass black hole, and other examples of galaxies with very strong radio sources. The third important property of black holes is the dragging of inertial frames, and I think this feature of black holes is becoming increasingly important from an astrophysical point of view with time. Of course, it wouldn't be any surprise if most of the black holes we see do have a significant amount of spin, and there are some good theoretical arguments that the spin of these black holes may be an important source of energy for the production of outflows, collimated outflows of plasma, which travel over very large distances, which go under the name of jets. Not only might black holes power these jets, but they also may play a crucial role in keeping their alignment. And also, if we can get some observational clues about the distribution of black hole spins, that may tell us something very important about how black holes formed and evolved. And I'll, if I have time, I will discuss that more later. Okay, let me discuss each of these features in order. As I began, the simplest feature of a black hole is probably just the strength of the gravitational potential. And if we drop material into the black hole and somehow it manages to radiate away a lot of the energy it requires, you can produce a very large source of power. Now, it's very unlikely that in any realistic situation material simply drops into a black hole, as Andy said, because in order to fall into a black hole, you have to have a very small angular momentum. The maximum angular momentum is some small multiple of gm over c, And this is extremely tiny by any astrophysical standard. So you don't really expect ever to get a situation where material can fall into a black hole unless it is able to lose the vast majority of the angular momentum that it starts out with. We believe that the way this is done in most circumstances, and there are many different possible ways you can think of, but we believe the way that this happens is that there is some kind of an analog of a viscosity, that the material orbiting the black hole goes into a sort of a differential rotation. The angular velocity is a function of distance from the hole, and the shear in the streams of gas then gives rise to a viscous stress which transports angular momentum outwards, and I've represented this by the symbol G, and in order to conserve angular momentum, inflow of matter is allowed at a rate that carries an equal and opposite amount of angular momentum inwards. Now, an important feature of this viscous torque is that this is a torque, this is a force acting from the inner regions of flow, the region closer to the black hole, which are spinning around faster, acting on the material further out. And because this torque is working on a system that's rotating, the torque also does work, and that is going to prove to be important. Now, if the energy that's released, that's acquired by the gas dropping into the gravitational potential, is radiated away, then pressure forces are extremely are unimportant dynamically, and in fact, all you have is the motion of the gas attempting to balance the inward force of gravity, and so we have what is geometrically a disk of gas, a thin accretion disk, and what happens there is that the gas spirals in gradually through a sequence of very nearly circular orbits with Keplerian angular velocities. And so you can just think about this as the gas at any given radius simply being in a circular orbit about the black hole. This gas is rubbing against the material further out and giving up its angular momentum gradually, and therefore is spiraling in. Now, you know that in classical general relativity, in black hole solution, you cannot keep a circular Keplerian orbit indefinitely. There is a minimum radius that the orbit can have and still be stable, so that if you perturb the orbit, the material would just oscillate around its original radius. And that so-called marginally stable orbit depends on the angular momentum of the hole. If you're dealing with a Schwarzschild hole, it's 6m, 3 Schwarzschild radii. And if you're dealing with a maximal Kerr hole, it's m, which is the event horizon radius in that case. So the idea is that material gradually spirals down to this innermost stable orbit under the action of viscosity, and once it gets to that point, its orbital motion becomes unstable, and then it can fall into the hole without any further dissipation. Now, that doesn't necessarily, without any further transport of angular momentum. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there is not any further transport of angular momentum, and in fact, one of the recent developments is that people have been worrying about possible physical processes that could be observable inside the innermost stable orbit. And, for example, Julian Krolik has recently proposed that viscous stresses might continue to be important and produce observable radiation from inside the innermost stable orbit. But you can say fairly generally that you get the following flow of energy in a thin accretion disk. The gravitational forces generate motion in the gas. You have the virial theorem operating here, of course, so as you spiral in, the orbital motion gets faster and faster. We believe we have a good model for the basis of this transport of angular momentum now. If there is even an infinitesimal magnetic field driven by currents in the accretion disk, in every astrophysical system we know of, there is at least a small magnetic field present. We have yet to find any system where, if you look hard enough, there's no evidence for a magnetic field whatsoever. If you have a small magnetic field operating in this highly conductive plasma, then the shear associated with the accretion disk will drive an instability, which is sometimes called the magnetorotational instability, and more often called the Balbus-Hawley instability, but it probably should be called the Balbus-Hawley-Chandrasekhar-Velikov instability, unless there's somebody else whose name should be attached to this as well. Sir? Yes. Well, this is inverse order of, this is an instability which was first noted many years ago, but is proving to be more and more important. And I don't really have time to discuss it, but it seems to be a very robust candidate for providing the viscous stress. The result is that you amplify the magnetic energy density in the accretion disk. That also then helps to transport angular momentum through the Maxwell stresses. And associated with this transport of angular momentum, there must be dissipation, whose details are uncertain, and in the case of a thin disk, that dissipation goes into radiation. Okay. So we think we actually have a pretty good scheme for how this works, and one important feature turns out to be that the local rate of dissipation, in this good example of a scrambled equation, is three times the local rate at which energy is released by the matter actually spiraling inwards in the accretion disk. Now, this was discovered very early in the days of accretion disk theory, and it was thought to be an interesting curiosity, but I'm going to argue that it may be of much more fundamental importance when we consider disks that are not so, accretion flows that are not so good at radiating away their energy. The reason for this discrepancy between the local rate of energy release and the local amount of energy that's actually dissipated and would be radiated away in this thin disk case is the fact that the viscous torque transports energy as well as angular momentum. And in the Keplerian part of an accretion disk, when you're still far from the black hole, two-thirds of the energy that's dissipated at any given radius is energy that is released by gravitational binding energy closer in and is transported outwards and dumped in this gas at the larger radius. Okay, there are many open questions about the details of how dissipative accretion disks occur. We don't know exactly how and where the dissipation takes place. If most of it is deep in the disk, then what we might expect is that the energy released could come close to thermal equilibrium, and you get something that's a fairly cool thermal spectrum of radiation. A fraction of the energy may well be dissipated outside the disk in the form of magnetic flares, in which case you might get a hot corona and wind, and these processes are very crucial to the observations of iron lines, for example, that Andy discussed in his last talk, because the idea is that the iron line is produced by fluorescence of material that is irradiated by X-rays coming from outside the disk. We also do not know very much about the global magnetic field structure. We don't know whether it's entirely chaotic or whether, in fact, it could have an ordered component. Now, if the disk is unable to radiate, then things become much more tricky. Because what happens then is that material is giving up its angular momentum and trying to move closer to the black hole, and thereby is acquiring energy from the gravitational, from falling into the gravitational potential, but that energy has no place to go. Only a part of that energy can go into increasing the kinetic energy of the motion of the gas around the black hole. The rest of it has to go into some internal form of energy inside the gas, which could be magnetic fields, and it's likely to be not only magnetic fields, but also internal particle energy, or perhaps internal particle energy, or perhaps some other form of energy. Or perhaps a lot of radiation is produced, but the radiation can't escape. And in this case, you get what has become to be called advection-dominated or perhaps adiabatic accretion, because the energy that's released by falling into the gravitational potential is trapped. Now, we believe that accretion with a low radiative efficiency occurs in two distinct and really opposite situations. When the rate at which material is flowing towards the black hole is extremely high, higher than the so-called Eddington limit, then the gas is so opaque that even though radiation is probably emitted very readily by this gas because it's fairly high density, it's accreting at a good clip, the photons are unable to escape in a short enough time to leave the system before the material loses its angular momentum and spiral down to the black hole. And what happens in that case is that the energy density of the radiation builds up, radiation exerts a pressure, and in fact you have a disk or a flow around the black hole that is not a thin disk, but it's inflated by the pressure of internal radiation. In the other extreme, when the rate at which material is flowing towards the black hole is very small, much smaller than this Eddington rate, the exact value depends on some assumptions, then the flow also has a low radiative efficiency, but for a very different reason. The reason is that the density is so low that you simply don't get the processes operating which produce radiation. This situation does require two additional assumptions. One is that the dissipated energy goes mainly into the protons and not the electrons, because electrons will radiate very effectively almost no matter what. And the other is that the protons and electrons don't share their energy and try to come into equipartition too quickly. And this whole model works very nicely if their rate of energy sharing is no faster than the rate of Coulomb scattering. Okay, and so in this case, the gas falls into the black hole before it has a chance to produce radiation. In this case, the gas falls into the black hole before the radiation that's produced has a chance to escape. And in either case, the luminosity becomes much smaller than the rate of mass flow times c squared. Okay, now it has been proposed that advection-dominated accretion could be a good test of the existence of an event horizon, and that's because if you have an accretion flow which is not able to radiate, it contains a lot of energy, and it's carrying that energy physically into the hole, that energy doesn't get out. The argument is that that can only occur around a black hole, because for any other object, even if it has a very deep gravitational potential, for example, a neutron star, you have a hard surface. And so when the gas hits the surface, eventually that energy will just sit there until it starts, it's released in real time, and that you would always have a fairly high efficiency when you accrete onto a neutron star. And there was an ingenious test that was made that was suggested by Ramesh Narayan and collaborators for the existence of the event horizon by comparing the radiative properties of X-ray binaries containing neutron stars versus those containing black holes, the argument being that in one population of sources you saw a much larger swing of luminosities than in the other population, and the idea was that those would be the ones where you were not forced to radiate away all the energy at the surface, and that population turned out to be the black holes. I think that one might want to try making tests of this sort, because there is indeed this important difference between black holes and other forms of compact objects, but there is a complication. And again, once more, the complication is the transport of energy from small radii to large radii by the viscous torque. And if you go beyond the transport of angular momentum, the viscous torque equaling the advection of angular momentum, you can also discuss the flow of energy and the viscous torque times the angular velocity must equal the mass flow times this quantity B, which is the Bernoulli function. The Bernoulli function is simply the kinetic energy of the gas plus the gravitational potential plus the enthalpy, and that basically is the amount of energy that would be left over if you took gas in this accreting material and allowed it to escape to infinity doing PdV work on its surroundings. And what you find is that if the accretion disk is unable to radiate away its energy, but nevertheless has this viscous torque transporting energy and angular momentum outwards, this Bernoulli function must become positive over a large fraction of the disk, and that means that the material in a radiatively inefficient disk has a very worrisome tendency to become unbound to its central source. And that's because not only is it releasing its energy out here, but it is acquiring energy that's released closer in. Well, it's very worrying to consider, at least for some of us, to consider that gas can accrete if it's capable of unbinding itself and flowing off to infinity with positive energy. And so one might imagine that a different scenario that results from advection-dominated accretion. And Roger Blanford and I have suggested that, in fact, what might happen is that you develop a very strong wind, removing enough energy and angular momentum from the system so that you do not develop this problem with a positive binding, a positive energy in the gas trying to get onto the black hole. I don't really have time to go into the details of this, but the important point to remember is that 1 gram of gas that reaches a radius close to the event horizon down here, if you can somehow take the energy that that gas releases and put a large fraction of it in the gas out here, it can liberate 1 kilogram of gas that's at 1,000 Schwarzschild radii from the black hole. And so the idea is that the viscous stress actually does that for you automatically, and we suspect might drive a wind. Now, one should, in principle, be able to simulate this type of process, and I want to just show you a very preliminary movie that has been made by Jim Stone, working at Cambridge this year. He's normally based in Maryland. And what you're going to see is the late-time evolution of a system which began, this is not a relativistic calculation, this is just some kind of an absorptive boundary condition. The simulation began with this is a cross-section. The gas is rotating out of the screen like this. This simulation began with a ring of gas situated somewhere. I don't know exactly where it started, but it had internal viscosity and was not able to radiate. So what happened is that this gas just heated up and surrounded the black hole and reached this wedge-like state. And what I'm going to show you is something that looks like that is apparently a late-time steady state. I believe that the color code is it density, Roger?
Density,
yes. Okay, and what you see here, motion is being driven, we believe, by convective instabilities that develop as a result of viscous dissipation. And what's happening is that material is predominantly accreting in the center and flowing out along the outside. And an important point here is that the amount of matter reaching the black hole is a very, very small fraction of the amount of matter that's introduced into the system at large distances. And so basically, most of the material is being turned around at various radii and leaving the system. Okay. Okay, now, for the third important characteristic, the dragging of inertial frames. This is meant to be the lens-Turing precession rate, the angular velocity of an inertial frame around a spinning black hole. It's proportional to the angular momentum of the black hole and drops off like radius as radius to the minus third power. This is just the precession rate as observed by a distance observer that a gyroscope would have at a given distance from the black hole. And as I'm going to try to argue, this is proving to be a very promising effect from an astrophysical standpoint for at least 3 reasons. The first reason is that we are finally reaching the point now where we can seriously consider not only measuring the masses of black holes, but also measuring their spins. And the spins of black holes, the distribution of spins, might be able to tell us a lot about how black holes formed and evolved. There are a couple of observational diagnostics of black hole angular momentum that now seem to be quite realistic. The first one has been titled Disco Seismology. And has been the ideas have been developed over the years by Kato and Wagner and Novak and others. And the idea there is that if you take an accretion disk and many other people, yes, and Rashi, yes. If you take an accretion disk and perturb the motion of the gas that's nearly in circular orbit, of course you can get oscillations in vertical and radial directions. And it turns out that Unlike the angular velocity of the material orbiting the black hole, the epicyclic frequencies, these frequencies of these perturbations, do not monotonically increase towards the black hole. They have a characteristic property which is purely determined by general relativistic effects. And in particular, the radial epicyclic frequency, and that is if you take the circular motion and perturb it inward and outward and watch the oscillations, the radial epicyclic frequency has a maximum, and then it turns over and then goes to zero at the, is it the innermost stable orbit or the event horizon? Well, anyway, it goes, which one is it? It's the stable orbit, that's right. Thank you. Okay. The point is that this can then act as a resonant cavity. And you can get waves, low-frequency branch of waves, which are analogous to gravity waves, in which the force of gravity and the pressure are opposing each other, I believe. And those types of waves can be trapped in this resonant cavity, and if you keep pumping them, their amplitudes can build up. The frequency of these waves, of course, has a range because depending on where these the turning points of these modes are, but they are generally expected to have a fairly small range. And so you might expect to see a fairly well-defined set of frequencies associated with these trapped waves, and the characteristic frequencies of these waves depend primarily on the mass of the black hole, as you might expect, because that determines the scale of the system, and it depends fairly sensitively on the angular momentum of the black hole. Well, one might ask, in fact, whether there's any evidence for these waves, and it is possible, though by no means proven. There are characteristic oscillations with particular frequencies that are seen with particularly fairly high frequencies that are seen in a couple of X-ray binaries. In one case, the frequency is about 67 hertz, and in another case, the period is about 300 hertz. We see a wide variety and a very rich spectrum of quasi-periodic oscillations. That means not purely periodic, but nearly so. This is a power density spectrum, and you see there's a well-defined peak here. But very few of these modes have a frequency which is actually rock stable. In these two cases, for these particular frequencies, whenever these modes appear, they appear always at the same frequency, and that leads people to suspect that these represent properties of the space-time geometry close to the black hole rather than properties of the gas dynamics and magnetic field, which are likely to fluctuate with time, because you see these sources are actually quite variable. In fact, they're much more variable than this. They turn on and off and do all kinds of things. If you were to carry this analysis through and ask what do these frequencies imply in this particular object, if the mass, we don't know the mass of the object, but you could have a mass of about 10.6 solar masses and a Schwarzschild black hole, or a mass of 36 solar masses and an extreme Kerr black hole. In the case of the second object, we actually do have a very good estimate of the mass from optical observations of the binary, and if you carry this analysis through, you would conclude that A over M is 0.93. Now, I should say that I discussed this model simply for illustrative purposes, but there are alternative models for explaining this quasi-periodicity. Some of them include the possible lens-Turing precession of part of a disk, the possibility that you could be looking at an orbital effect due to some hot spots on the disk. There might be oscillations of the place where the material flows from the disk into the black hole, or there might be these might actually be pressure-driven modes which are stalling near the innermost stable orbit. Now, I do have a movie just to give you an idea of what these trapped modes look like. And let's try that. And this is a simulation by Mike Novak. And what you see is, this is gravitational radii relative to the black hole. I can't move the scale up there. What you see is that these are pressure perturbations. The disk is thickening. That's why there's a very large pressure perturbation here, because this is basically moving into regions where there wasn't any disk before. And it's sloshing back and forth. So it's a sloshing mode, and it's driving material out the surface of the disk. Now, again, it's very complicated to take these simple estimates of a frequency spectra and turn them into observations. We do not know, for example, how these modes would couple to the X-ray emission from the disk and give you the observed X-ray signature. But this is one intriguing candidate, and there are others. Okay, now, the other possible diagnostic of black hole spin that seems feasible is to look at the X-ray reverberation mapping of these iron lines that Andy talked about, and I won't go through the details of this because Andy really explained this thoroughly. If we are lucky, and there are some observational suggestions to this effect, these iron lines might be due to the illumination of the disk by discrete flares, which simply turn on, send a light echo across the disk, which is, appears in the response of these iron lines, and then turn off. If the situation is as simple as that, we may have a chance of at least partially inverting the problem, doing the inverse problem, which is to take these time-dependent spectra, the sequence of spectra of the shape of this X-ray line as a function of time, and hopefully to do it for many different flares that might occur in different locations, and use that to reconstruct the space-time geometry around the hole, the geometry and physical properties of both the disk and the flare, and to try to get a picture of how accretion is occurring and what the properties of the black hole are. And I should add that these types of observations may well be become feasible with the next generation of X-ray satellites. First, the XMM mission, which is due to be launched in a few months, and hopefully later, Constellation X. And let me just show you a simulation of one of these echoes and the signature that you might actually be able to observe with one of these satellites. And these are simulations that were run by Chris Reynolds at JILA and Andy Young at Cambridge. Okay, so what you're going to see here, actually I don't need a loop. What you see here is a Doppler shift map of an accretion disk viewed from an angle of 30 degrees off the axis. The black hole is essentially extreme Kerr, and you'll see the time marching along here. The flare is located above the spin axis of the hole at a distance of 10 gravitational radii, I believe. Is it gravitational radii or Schwarzschild radii? Gravitational radii. Okay, so let's start this. And what you'll see down here is the spectrum of the response. First, the actual computed spectrum, and then folded through a noise response function and a noise simulation for Constellation X. You will see the actual location of the echo as viewed by this observer as a dark band across this this disk. Okay. It takes some time for the echo to first hit the disk because of the height. And there you see. And you see that it's bifurcating and a piece of it is going into the hole. And there you get the red line shifting off as this fragment of the echo goes into the black hole. There you see the double horn profile that Andy discussed with the asymmetries due to relativistic effects. And just to show you that this is can in principle be observed, this is what you might see with a sequence of Constellation X spectra. And you see a very clear signal there, and you see it marching towards lower energies. This actually has a lot of information in it. Those of you who are familiar with astrophysical data will see this is a very strong signal. Does anyone want to deny that? Okay. Oops. Okay. Just say a few words about the possibility of aligning disks and jets. There are actually some open questions about this, but let me just describe the basic effect. I'll use the overhead for a minute. Here, if we imagine the gas orbiting at a particular radius by this flat ring of gas, and the orbits will basically be planar because the orbital time scale is much shorter than the precession time scale due to the Lenz-Turing effect once you get any distance away from the hole. So you can imagine this ring precessing about some mean axis due to the Lenz-Turing effect. However, the rings of gas in an accretion disk are not independent entities. They are linked to one another by these viscous stresses, and so you have to visualize the disk as having a warp in it. And Jim Bardeen and Koos Pedersen recognized in the 1970s that, in fact, if you had a viscous disk subject that was misaligned with the black hole, with the spin of the black hole, and subject to the Lenz-Turing precession, that you might actually have a radius at some finite point in the disk where the precession time scale was of the same order of magnitude as the time scale for the viscous transport of angular momentum. And at that point, in fact, the warping would be damped out, and the disk would align to the equatorial plane of the black hole. And so this is a very appealing candidate for the for keeping the orientations of jets very well aligned. And in fact, we see jets that seem to be traveling over millions of light years with very well-defined alignments. I should say that there are some open questions here, because what this means is that the black hole can couple to the angular momentum in the disk possibly at a fairly large radius compared to the radius of the event horizon, and therefore, in fact, the black hole can use a large fraction of its own angular momentum in coupling to the disk, and this angular momentum of the black hole can also be transported by viscous stresses in the disk. And so one possibility is that, in fact, if you have misaligned accretion onto a black hole for any significant length of time, and it occurs at a high enough rate and under the right conditions, you could, in fact, also change the orientation of the black hole. And this is perhaps one question that might be discussed among the participants of the workshop here. That's all I really want to say about that, because I want to get on to what is perhaps the most dramatic manifestation of a black hole's interaction with its environment, and that is the production of relativistic jets. Now, what I'm going to say in the end is that there is a good chance that these jets might be powered by tapping the spin energy of the black hole. And let me just remind you that particles around a spinning black hole inside the ergosphere can have negative total energy, in the sense that if they are accreted by the black hole with these negative total energies, the mass of the black hole actually can go down. And of course, that is the basis of the Penrose process. The Penrose process, unfortunately, requires fairly specialized conditions to operate with a high degree of efficiency. And so I think most astrophysicists who've looked at this have concluded that it's hard to see a way that classical Penrose process involving particle production in the ergosphere can be important astrophysically. But in fact, there are versions of the Penrose process involving virtual photons associated with large-scale magnetic fields, and an example of that is the Blanford-Zniak effect, which I will talk about a little bit later. Right. The question is, where was I supposed to go from here? Ah. Okay. Double click, yes. Okay, relativistic jets. The evidence seems to suggest that relativistic jets are formed by a minority of accreting black holes. In the case of the supermassive black holes, it appears to be roughly 10 or 20%. We have very poor statistics in the case of stellar remnants. I think there may be about a dozen cases known. There was a very interesting workshop for 2 days in Paris in December about this, and observations are coming thick and fast, but this field is still in an early stage. For those of you who don't know, by the way, Cygnus X1 apparently has a one-sided jet, which has now been mapped by very long baseline interferometry in the radio. So that's one case of a classical black hole candidate, which has now been seen to have a jet. And this was shown at the meeting in Paris. There is very strong evidence that most of these jets have highly relativistic motion, and in fact they can have highly relativistic motion over very large distances. The evidence comes from many different types of observations. Let me just start with the bottom one because I don't have pictures of this. In many black active galaxies, highly variable and very energetic gamma rays have been observed with energies ranging from the GEV range up to the TEV range. And the crucial observation there for deciding the nature of the outflow is that these are very highly variable, and they therefore seem to be coming from a very small region, but if they really were coming from a very small region, you would get too much pair production, and that would absorb the gamma rays. I don't really have time to go into detail of that. The bottom line is that we have evidence that the Lorentz factors for the supermassive black hole jets can easily be in the range of 5 to 10 or more, and we have somewhat less stringent constraints on the stellar remnant objects. Well, here is a very nice example showing the one-sidedness of jets. This is a montage in the radio of M87 on many different scales. The distance across here is about 250,000 light years, but jets are observed to travel over distances of about up to 5 or more million light years. And each frame here shows a higher and higher resolution until you get down to here. And what you see here is that there is definitely a well-collimated flow on this scale here, which is, if we believe the estimate of 3 billion solar masses for this black hole, this is less than 100 gravitational radii. And so these jets are really being formed very close in. Now, in this object, we also have evidence of relativistic motion. And let me show you the Hubble public relations version of this, which John Barreto was kind enough to loan me. Let's try this one. Oops. Ah. Is it looping? No, let's not try this one. Okay. Yes, there we go. Okay. This is going to give you a typical zoom that Hubble often gives you. So this is a Hubble optical image of the jet of M87. The nucleus of the galaxy is there. And I think we're going to zoom in on this little spot here. And then it's going to show you a sequence of three images taken a couple of years apart. We know the distance to this galaxy to be a little bit more than 50 megaparsecs. 50 million light years, about 16 or 17 megaparsecs, and if that translates into a velocity, it corresponds to an apparent velocity on the sky of 6 times the speed of light. That velocity, of course, is not thought to be real. It's thought to be an illusion due to the fact that this jet is pointing just a few degrees away from our line of sight. Blobs are coming outwards, or perhaps there's a pattern of shocks coming outwards. It's at least 18 degrees. It's got to be less than 18 degrees with these velocities. Some pattern of shocks or perhaps physical blobs are coming out almost at us, and because they're getting closer to us with time, the light travel distance between us and the blobs is decreasing very rapidly, and that makes them appear to be moving away from the center at faster than the speed of light. So it's very likely that these jets are really relativistic. The one-sidedness is believed to be due to the Doppler beaming of the radiation from the jet, because we also have very good evidence that intrinsically these jets really are close to being symmetric. And so you might ask what propulsion mechanism might be able to account for these high velocities. And again, I'm running out of time here, but you can rule out some obvious ones, such as the release of gas pressure through adiabatic decompression or the propulsion of the jet through radiation pressure, because it is simply too difficult to get velocities this close to the speed of light from those mechanisms. And in fact, the only suggestion that has really stood the test of time up to now seems to be the action of organized electromagnetic stresses, and this is where black holes come back in, because The Blanford-Snyak effect is essentially a version of a Penrose process involving magnetic field lines which connect the event horizon of the black hole to very distant regions compared to the gravitational radius. What you need for this effect to operate is a spinning black hole and a magnetic field threading the horizon. That field has to be generated by external currents, currents flowing in an external medium, for example, in an accretion disk. What happens if you have these magnetic fields anchored at a very large distance and they are not spinning with the same angular velocity as the angular velocity of the black hole, as measured by an observer at large distances watching an observer close to the hole, watching somebody close to the hole, if there is a mismatch between those angular velocities and the field is spinning more slowly than the hole, then in fact you generate an EMF between the equator and the pole, you can get currents to flow, and you can extract spin energy from the hole up to the limit that's given by the irreducible mass of the hole. So in principle, as much as almost 30% of the rest mass energy associated with the gravitational field of the hole would be available. And that's a huge amount of energy. It's 10 to the 63 ergs for the black hole in M87 if it is spinning close to maximal Kerr. And we don't understand a great deal about the details of this mechanism, and I'm sure one of the objectives of the workshop here will be to discuss this mechanism in a lot more detail. Well, there are more unsolved problems related to the astrophysics of black holes than there are solved problems, and I could go through a long list of them. In fact, I have a long list of them in the subsequent slides, but apparently I don't have time to show them. But someone could ask me about them. So let me just conclude by saying that that the study of the astrophysics of black holes has really come a very long way since the days when we were still worrying about, one, whether we could detect dark masses if they existed, and two, whether these dark masses really represent dense star clusters or some ordinary type of object as opposed to black holes. I think the evidence has really shifted overwhelmingly in favor of black holes really being extremely common objects, and now we are worrying about very detailed questions about how the metric of the black hole interacts with its surroundings and how these black holes are formed and fit in with the general scheme of things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question?
In the movie you showed for the radiative being inefficient with alpha, it looked like the accretion within the disk was actually episodic. Is there a natural time scale for the episodic?
That's a good question. I don't think we know the answer to that yet. You would notice that along the midplane of the disk, it looks like there's very messy convective motion, and we think that that is very messy convective motion, that in fact you're getting buoyancy operating in the equatorial plane. But most of the energy and angular momentum seems to be conveyed towards those surfaces where the material is flowing out. And that's what you'd expect because it's much easier to match the convective stability criterion along the equatorial plane than it is to match it in the perpendicular direction. And you can show that if you consider the full criterion for convective stability, which is called the Hoyland criterion.
I think I can answer this question. We make similar simulation in Göteborg, mm-hmm. and there's a time scale formation of convective bubbles, which is roughly thermal bubbles.
Yeah.
Other questions? Jean-Pierre.
Okay. Right. There. Some unsolved problems. Okay, let me just go through these quickly. There are some of these problems are involving the actual the nature of radiative inefficient accretion. I think now we have a debate that we can have over if you throw material towards a black hole, give it some viscosity, so it would be a tendency to accrete, but you don't allow it to radiate, what fraction of the matter reaches the black hole? I think it's possible that, in fact, the black hole throws away most of the material that you send its way, and only a small fraction reaches the center. Of course, this gives an alternative explanation for if you see sources with very low very small amounts of radiation coming out. It might simply mean, it might be partly that the material that's coming towards the black hole can't radiate, but it may also be that the material that's approaching the black hole actually never makes it very deep into the potential. And it also would have a very important, it would make a big difference in the way black holes grow, because it would mean that that black holes can't grow through accretion of radiatively inefficient gas. What determines the transition between the adiabatic and radiative regimes of accretion? In fact, in many situations, you can get two stable situations, and there's still no agreement as to what determines the one that's chosen. An interesting particular case of radiatively inefficient accretion, from an observational point of view, involves the tidal disruption of a star that gets too close to a black hole. Any black hole less massive than about a few hundred solar masses will be able to disrupt tidally an ordinary star that gets close enough. And in this case, the gas is so dense that it's likely to be the radiation is likely to be trapped. This process must occur frequently because we know that these black holes sit in the nuclei of galaxies and where the star densities are very high, but we don't know that much about the observational signatures. Martin Rees and many other groups, I think, have been worrying about this problem over the last few years. Measuring the black hole spin, I've already touched on many of these issues. It would be interesting if we could observe these stable quasi-periodic oscillations in supermassive black holes and find out what causes them in the smaller black holes. Reverberation mapping of the X-rays, we really have very little idea of how to invert the data right now. There's no unique inversion, I suspect, in most cases. So this will involve luck as well as being clever. Gravitational radiation from black hole mergers, of course, gravitational radiation signatures are one of the cases where, in principle, the signature can be calculated in great detail and carries an enormous amount of information, including information about the spin of the holes. Regarding the extraction of energy from the black hole, the Blandford-Znaik effect has been sketched out in general, but really very few of the details have filled in. We don't know what determines the amount of magnetic field that threads the black hole. We don't know how much of this energy from the spin would react back on the accretion flow and possibly modify the rate at which material approaches the black hole. We don't know how these electromagnetic outflows of energy might get loaded down with matter as they propagate, and we also don't know the relative role of the Blandford-Znaik process compared to the possible extraction of energy directly from the accretion disk through the creation of magnetized winds, and we actually don't know what determines whether you get a jet or not, because there are many factors that could be involved. This is the last one. Origin of evolution of supermassive black holes is really hardly understood at all. In fact, I would say it's not understood really at all. There have been claims that there is a rough proportionality between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the bulge of the galaxy in which it's situated, which I have down here as 0.005, but I think the exact number is debatable. Important question is whether we should believe this correlation. If we believe it, we need an explanation for it. Does it have something to do with the hierarchical merging of the pieces that went together to form galaxies, or is this correlation created in some other way? Any mechanism for the formation of supermassive black holes might make a pretty good, robust prediction for the distribution of black hole spins. For example, if a black hole grows through a very long episode of accreting gas, which has the same orientation all the time because it's coming from a single galaxy or something like that, then you might expect the black hole to be pretty well spun up. And in fact, it's very difficult to prevent a black hole from getting spun up by simply radiating away the spin energy through the Blandford-Znaik process. And this is a work that was done by Rafael Modersky and Marek Shikora. But if you have hierarchical merging of many, many small black holes to form a big black hole, it seems unlikely that the spins of those small black holes would be correlated, and their angular momenta would be orbital angular momenta would be correlated, and so you might expect that the RMS angular momentum would be very small. And finally, we are virtually certain that there must be black hole binaries. We may or may not have seen direct evidence for them, but the abundance and distribution of black hole binaries could, first of all, tell us something about how black holes form and grow. We would want to learn something about their gravitational radiation. This is a very promising signal for the LISA detector. And also the recoil from mergers, whether the gravitational radiation momentum can actually knock a black hole clear out of a galaxy. So,
thank you.
Enough. And all of these problems will be solved by the end of June.
Okay, thank you very much.